Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Thank you very much for having me today. The title of the talk is, as you can see, well, I'll say it again, How to Be a Good Friend Combating Envy and Apathy, Exercising Love and Wisdom. I'll first discuss the relationship of friendship and human flourishing. I aim to show how living with an adequate vision of human flourishing is essential to being a good friend. This theoretical groundwork sets up my discussion of two virtues that build and maintain friendship: love and wisdom, and two vices that harm or end friendships: envy and apathy. My general advice today for how to be a good friend is to understand true human happiness, avoid these vices, and pursue these virtues. If this sounds too abstract, I beg your patience. This talk will get very practical by the end. So to proceed, let's now turn to work that motivates the importance of friendship and then turns to the nature of human flourishing. And then we will. So Robert Waldinger is the director of the Harvard Study of Adult Development, which followed men from their teenage years at Harvard into their 90s. It's still underway and is the longest study of its kind. In summarizing the results as reported by the Harvard Gazette, Waldinger said this: "Loneliness," this is a quote, "loneliness kills. It's as powerful as smoking or alcoholism. The surprising finding is that our relationships and how happy we are in our relationships has a powerful influence on our health." And also says, "Taking care of your body is important, but tending to your relationship is a form of self-care too. That, I think, is the revelation." End quote. The main lesson here is that long-term health is greatly influenced by the health of our relationships. Health is an important ingredient in human flourishing, although it is not flourishing itself. We can be healthy and still not be flourishing. You probably don't need a study to tell you that loneliness isn't great for you. But the study helps us appreciate anew the importance of friendship to flourishing. I propose there's a connection between a person's view of human flourishing and his or her notion of friendship. Inadequate views of human flourishing can lead to inadequate views of friendship. If we don't get flourishing right, we may not get friendship right either. And we should care about getting both right. And so I'll now discuss some examples of inadequate accounts of human flourishing and friendship, and then turn to what I take to be the best accounts of flourishing and friendship. It's evident that we all want, desire to flourish. We all want a good life. But it isn't obvious what such a life consists in, so we must think carefully about what it is and how to get it. To get us thinking, let's go back to ancient Greece and attend to the philosophy of Aristotle. Aristotle was a 4th century philosopher who lived during the Golden Age of Greece. He was a student of Plato, who is the student of Socrates. He wrote learned treatises on a great number of subjects. These treatises were so insightful and penetrating that some of them exert significant influence up to this day. Even if you think he's mistaken about the good life, he's worth paying attention to. In his Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle observes that every person acts for an end. That is, a goal. For example, eating dinner after this talk may be an end or goal of yours. You'll have to choose various means to reaching your goal of eating dinner, such as figuring out where to go, how to get there, and then what to eat. If you're asked, why are you going to dinner? Answers you might give include, I enjoy eating, or I need energy, or I want to hang out with friends. So eating dinner isn't merely an end of yours. It's also a means to something else, such as gaining energy or spending time with friends. We pursue means and ends all the time. The ends we pursue are sometimes also means to further ends. Let me illustrate further. Suppose I ask you why you're taking courses at the University of Michigan for you students. You might say because you want a degree from here. I then ask why you want this degree. You might say because you want a good job. I then ask why you want a good job. You might say that so you can support yourself and perhaps a family. And then I ask why you want that. And at this point, you may get a little puzzled. If you're like my students, you'll then give answers such as, I want a good life, and I see that this is all a part of that. Or I want to be happy. And if I were to ask you why you want to be happy, you would probably find yourself without an answer to give. And you'd probably say, I just want that. We've reached the final end, the end of all your other ends. Aristotle calls this the chief good. Aristotle observes that there has to be something we treat as the final end or chief good of our life. Something that's not a means to anything else, but simply is an end. If we didn't have a final end in mind, we would never begin anything. Furthermore, Aristotle thinks that human beings desire everything else for the sake of their final end. He says that we all agree in general about what the final end is, a good life, or happiness, what he calls eudaimonia. Everyone desires this. Everyone desires to live, as we say today, his or her best life. If we all want happiness in this sense, then one of the most important questions we need to ask or to answer is, in what does happiness consist? What is the best life to live? If you ask different people the question, you'll likely get different answers. Someone might change his answer depending on what's going on in his life. If he's sick, for example, he might think the answer is health. Aristotle considers different answers before offering his own, and I'll mention two answers that he rejects and then discuss their potential implications for how a person views friendship. The first answer to the question, what is a good life, is a life of enjoyment. On this view, the best life is the one with the greatest sensory pleasure. For example, enjoying good food and drink, having stimulating experiences, Instagram-worthy vacations, and etc. Aristotle acknowledges the goodness of pleasure or enjoyment, but he says that a life of sensory pleasure is not enough for us. He says it's a life fit for cows, not human beings. What does he mean? If we were to ask what makes for a happy cow, we'd probably say that the best cow life requires food, drink, shelter, the comforting presence of other cows, and making baby cows. That's enough for a cow. But a human being could have ready access to the pleasures of food, drink, shelter, society, and sex, and still be unhappy, unfulfilled. While these pleasures have their place, and our sensory pleasures are greater in scope than a cow's, Aristotle claims that to live for sensory pleasure alone is to live as if the cow's best life is our own. But we're not cows, and their good life is not ours. Consider how we might view friends if we held this view. Suppose we live for sensory enjoyment, and we ordered everything we did to gaining the most enjoyment we could. On this view, it would be tempting to view friends as playing an important role in our happiness through being enjoyable to us. We might value them merely as a means to the joy they bring to us in our lives. If they cease to bring joy to us, we would move on to find other more enjoyable friends. But I submit this is a shallow form of friendship that will, like the vision of happiness as enjoyment, leave us unfulfilled and not the kind of people that would be good friends. Of course, it's a good thing to enjoy your friends, but we shouldn't care about our friends merely because they bring us pleasure or enjoyment. A second account of the good life holds that the best life is being wealthy. Aristotle recognizes the goodness of wealth, but he says that wealth cannot be the final end, for wealth is clearly desired as means to something else. People want wealth to buy houses, cars, clothes, entertainment, travel, education, etc. Wealth is not desired for its own sake or as a final end. Therefore, it cannot be what happiness ultimately consists in. This may strike you as a surprise, given it appears that many people order their life around accumulating wealth. Some wealth, or another means of access to the goods it can buy, is necessary for a good life. We need food, clothing, and shelter to survive. We need a suitable education to thrive. Usually, money is the means of securing these things. And so we rely on money to some extent. But the best life requires much more than having the money to meet those basic needs, as we can see in the lives of unhappy, wealthy people. We cannot treat money, which is merely a means, as the final end of our life. How might we view friends on this view? If our lives were ordered around accumulating money or what money can buy, we would be tempted to view our friends as useful to us in advancing our careers and securing greater wealth. We might value them as merely a means to the wealth they help us to secure. But I submit this is a shallow form of friendship too. It will, like the view that wealth will make us happy, leave us personally and socially unfulfilled and not the kind of people that would be good friends. That's not to say that our friends should never be useful to us. But we shouldn't care about our friends merely because they're useful to us in getting what we want. Many people might live with a combination of these two views. They take sensory pleasure to be the highest good, and wealth is the most important means to achieving a life of sensory pleasure. And they only pursue friendships of pleasure and usefulness. What is happiness for Aristotle? Aristotle understands the good of something to depend on the kind of thing it is. So the good or flourishing of a human being will depend on what a human being is. The good of a cow will depend on what a cow is, and the good of a tomato will depend on what a tomato is. The good of a human being will differ from the good of the cow or tomato. A good tomato life is to grow, bear fruit, ripen, then reproduce itself via its seeds. But what is a good human life? In order to answer this question, Aristotle's first step is to ask, what is a human being? And for four he reasons, if we can figure out what we are, we'll figure out what makes us good, and so what makes for us to have a good life. So, let's look at his answer. Aristotle claims in general, things flourish when they perform what he calls their characteristic activity well. For example, playing the guitar is the characteristic activity of a guitar player. To play the guitar well is to flourish or to be good as a guitar player. But what's the characteristic activity of you and me? Aristotle argues that this is the activity of using our reason. By reason, we come to know important truths and make choices that transcend our instincts. Our reason is what makes us distinct from other animals, despite their impressive cognitive powers. Our reason is what brings a governing unity to the use of our other capacities and to our lives. We typically identify more with our reason and choices based on reason than our immediate desires and emotions. Recall the last time you broke a diet out of an impulsive decision. If you berated yourself afterward, wasn't it because you identify more with your deliberate rational choice than your impulsive desire? If the activity of reason is the human characteristic activity, then we flourish as human beings when we use our reason well. Using our reason well includes understanding things, making good choices, and fostering reasonable emotional responses regarding the situations and people we encounter, and the actions we pursue. Aristotle calls these activities in accord with reason. Aristotle calls the habits that dispose us to activities in accord with reason virtues. Virtues are good habits, then, of thinking, choosing, and emotionally responding that are essential to human flourishing. They make us able to do reasonable things reliably, easily, and with pleasure, or at least without pain. Aristotle argues that a good life, a happy life, is a life characterized by such virtuous activity. And this will be done, for Aristotle, with friends. Aristotle argues that his account explains what is plausible in the other accounts while avoiding their weaknesses. He claims his account will lead to an overall enjoyable life, although enjoyment is not its goal. For a person who gains pleasure from doing virtuous activity will enjoy much of what she does. Furthermore, she will be free from the significant psychological conflict and pain that characterizes the unvirtuous. Aristotle claims that virtuous activity may require some measure of wealth, depending on the circumstances. For example, practicing the virtue of generosity through hosting a dinner party for friends requires you to possess wealth beyond meeting your most basic needs. Finally, Aristotle's account is applicable to many different states of life. A life characterized by virtuous activity could be lived out as a business person, stay-at-home parent, author, musician, engineer, computer scientist, psychologist, or whatever. All could lead such a life. The wealthy and the unwealthy could walk such a path. Those with power and public influence and those without could do so. They all must live a life of virtuous activity with friends, but the circumstances in which those virtues are exercised will differ according to the individual. What is friendship? Friends are vital for our flourishing because we're social animals who need each other for good lives. Aristotle's basic notion of friendship is that it is a relationship characterized by mutual goodwill, of which both parties are aware, that's based on some likeness between them. I'll say that again. Aristotle's basic notion of friendship is that it's a relationship characterized by mutual goodwill, of which both parties are aware, that's based on some likeness between them. He distinguishes three kinds of friendship. The first two will sound familiar. And in another place, I've summarized his view like this. The first are friendships of utility, which are based on mutual benefit. The second are friendships of pleasure, which are based on mutual pleasure. The third are complete or virtuous friendships, which are based on mutual love for the other for his or her own sake. That is, for his character or who he or she is as a person. In this friendship, there's a likeness of character between the friends. He notes some similarities and differences between these three kinds of friendship. Friendships of pleasure or utility are not necessarily bad, but they are incomplete friendships. The good and the bad have them. They're not necessarily long-lasting. They're quick and easy to form and dissolve, and they're possible with many people. By contrast, only the good have complete friendships. Complete friendships are long-lasting. They are slower and more difficult to form and dissolve. They are rarer and possible only with a few. End quote. In short, the fullest and most complete kind of friends, what we'll call good friends, are those who care about, those we care about, for their own sake, and not merely because they are pleasant or useful to us. We say to these friends, I love you for who you are as a person, not merely because I enjoy doing things with you or because our relationship is mutually beneficial. Again, it's not that friends cannot also be pleasing and useful to us, important qualification, but these are not the basis for complete or good friendships. Such friendships depend on both people pursuing a genuinely good life and forming a character growing in virtue. Such friends want to be with each other. So these I'm calling good friends. It's the good friend who will sacrifice his own pleasure or benefit for the sake of his friend. Aristotle writes, and I use the Roger Crisp translation here, that for his friend, a good friend will, quote, sacrifice money, honors, and in general the goods for which people compete, procuring for himself what is noble. In fact, she is even willing to die for her friend. Consequently, if we want to summarize Aristotle's view of human flourishing, a good life or happiness, it's that flourishing is a life characterized by virtuous activity with good friends. Notice that the account of human flourishing built on virtuous activity fits well with the account of human friendship based on love for the other person's goodness as a person. Fundamentally, what we are living for makes a difference for the content and direction of our character. If my life is oriented toward pursuing what is genuinely good in itself, then I will be both attracted to and attractive to those who are also pursuing what is good. What we are ultimately living for shapes the persons we become. The person we are determines what kind of friend we will be and what kind of friends we will attract. You might be worried at this point and think to yourself, to flourish, I need good friends. But to have good friends, I need to be flourishing through virtuous activity. But I'm not virtuous. Am I stuck with a life of loneliness forever and doomed to unhappiness? Maybe none of you went there, but maybe some of you did. How can I form a good friendship given where I'm at? Can those friends help me to grow in virtue even where I lack it? Now, it's arguable that Aristotle would give a gloomy answer to these questions, but I think there's reason for hope. I think good friendships do not require both parties to be fully virtuous, even if they do require that both parties share a reasonably similar vision of human flourishing. If one person is ultimately living to acquire wealth and another is seeking to become good and do good, then I doubt they will reciprocate the love needed for a complete friendship. However, if both parties are striving for virtue and seeking to do good, then I think they can have a good or complete friendship and help one another on that way. In sum, good friends help us to become good. I'll now mention some of the benefits of good friends here and then turn to the virtues of a good friend and vices that undermine friendship. Aristotle discusses some of these benefits, and an author named Paul Waddell discusses even more. And so drawing from both of them, here are some of the benefits of a good friend. Friends help us to grow in love, to know ourselves, especially our strengths and weaknesses. They encourage us to keep our eye on the goal that we are living for, and by words, living for and accompanying us on the journey. They provide companionship during the storms and triumphs of life. They help us avoid mistakes, especially when we're young. They increase our capacity to think and act in doing great and noble deeds, especially in middle age. And they help us to finish work we've begun that we cannot finish on our own, especially when we're old. I'll say more especially about how friends help us to grow in love. And because most of you are young, I'm going to talk about how they help us avoid mistakes too. For the next part of the talk on virtues and vices related to friendship, we're going to include St. Thomas Aquinas, a medieval philosopher and theologian. For Aristotle and Aquinas, happiness goes beyond pleasure and wealth, and as well as health and honor. It must be a life that befits and fulfills our nature as rational and social beings. But for Aquinas, unlike Aristotle, virtuous activity with friends in this life alone cannot perfectly fulfill us. We will still have trouble and face disappointment and death here. There will always be some reasonable desire left unfulfilled, even in the best of lives here. If we are to be perfectly fulfilled, Aquinas says, we must enjoy everlasting and perfect virtuous activity with friends, where God is the first and best friend that we know and love forever in eternity. Now I'll focus more practically on the two virtues to pursue and vices to avoid, to be a good friend. The virtue most needed for friendship is love. Aristotle writes, quote, since friendship consists more in loving than being loved, it appears that loving is the virtue of friends. To be a good friend, you must love the other person for his or her own sake, rather than simply because they're pleasant or useful. In the Christian tradition, to love a person for his own sake is called charity. Charity centrally refers to the love of God for his own sake that God gives us by grace. Hence, Aquinas writes, it's evident that charity is the friendship of man for God. End quote. This love overflows into the love of neighbor. For Aquinas, to love someone is to will their good. This is sometimes called benevolence, which literally means to will the good. So for our purposes, we'll think of charity as the disposition to will the good of another for their own sake. Notice that this makes an act of charity a voluntary act. It's not the emotion of love, although that emotion may accompany it. In a complete friendship, there's a mutual attraction to the other due to their good character. Loving a person for the kind of person they are helps us to grow in charity by helping us to focus on someone other than ourselves and through meeting the demands of the friendship through personal sacrifice for the sake of the friend. To grow in charity, we must also expand the scope of our charity to include everyone. Every human being, as a human being, deserves basic charity. To will the highest good for a person is to will their ultimate flourishing. This is to will that they too would have a life of virtuous activity. Such a will is necessary for complete friendship, but we ought also to will the good of those who are not our friends. Why? We have charity for ourselves, we will our own good for its own sake, and they're human beings like us, willing the good for themselves like us, and their flourishing consists in virtuous activity with friends like us. Hence, they're relevantly like us, and we ought to treat them with the same basic goodwill with which we treat ourselves. Given this, the most important piece of advice for how to be a good friend and to gain, keep, and not lose friends is to love them with a love of charity. Now let's look at two vices contrary to charity and so to friendship. What's a vice? Vices are unfulfilling habits that contribute to unhappiness. Vices are formed by repeated bad choices, such as choosing something wrong, failing to do something right, failing to correct our unreasonable emotional responses, and so on. Vices make it easier for us to make bad choices and respond poorly to situations. They contribute to self-deception, and they undermine our good and the good of others. The vice we'll focus on first that undermines being a good friend is called spiritual apathy, which is also called sloth or sloth. Apathy means without pathos or to lack love, care, or concern. In his On Evil, Aquinas defines spiritual apathy as a habit of sadness or pain at a spiritual and interior good. Let's unpack this definition. This sadness or pain is not simply emotional, but involves a tendency to deliberately withdraw from such goods when one should not. Spiritual and interior goods, in contrast with material goods, are not seen, tasted, or touched. They are goods such as knowledge and friendship. You can see the effects of knowledge and friendship, but you can't see the knowledge itself, although you can see the book, nor can you see the friendship itself, although you can see your friend. Knowledge and love for a friend are interior. Knowledge and love for a friend are interior to us. Spiritual apathy is a disordered avoidance of and sadness at such goods due to a lack of proper love for them. Since spiritual apathy, such as knowledge of spiritual goods, such as knowledge and friendship, are crucial to happiness, spiritual apathy is a significant cause of unhappiness. In her excellent book, Glittering Vices, Rebecca DeYoung calls spiritual apathy fittingly, quote, resistance to the demands of love. There can be various sorts of spiritual apathy, but Aquinas focuses on one kind of apathy, about love for God, whose friendship is the ultimate source of happiness. I'll focus my discussion on apathy about love for human friends. The spiritually apathetic person is saddened by and withdraws from his love for a friend and what that love requires. He doesn't care enough for the friendship. How is one saddened? By a friendship. A person is saddened because the friendship is seen as bad in being an impediment to something else that's desired. When I'm apathetic about my love for a friend, it may be because what love requires of me gets in the way of my own comfort or plans or desires, which I care about more in the case than the friendship. The apathetic person is saddened because she treats the friendship as imposing a burden on her. For example, two friends have committed to sharing a morning coffee once a week, but one of them habitually chooses to sleep in because the comfort of staying in bed outweighs in her mind the good of keeping her commitment to the friend. To go deeper, the love for a spouse requires commitment and willingness to change. If a husband doesn't love his wife enough, then that commitment and change will be burdensome and so bring a certain sadness or even resentment. The apathetic are saddened primarily due to a lack of love, and not simply because they're averse to the work it requires. They have failed to cultivate love as they ought. When Aquinas speaks of sadness, he has in mind more than just the emotion of sadness. It also refers to this freely willed withdrawal from something. It manifests itself as desire and choice to avoid what love requires. And this choice to withdraw from love, or the choice not to foster that love, are choices for which I'm responsible and then contribute to the emotions of sadness that may occur. How does spiritual apathy contribute to unhappiness? Well, it's it's unreasonable and unfulfilling because I'm spiritually apathetic. When I am, I'm failing to do what love or duty requires, and I'm treating something less important as more important than it really is. So here's another example. I'm comfortably relaxing. My friends call and really need my help. Suppose there isn't a good reason for me not to help. What's holding me back is that I don't want to sacrifice my comfort for my friendship. I'm apathetic if I fail to love my friend by sacrificing my comfort for my friend. Acting out of love for my friend was the greater spiritual good I was avoiding by refusing to help him. Even if I do help, spiritual apathy can make me sluggish to do what love requires. And clearly this is not conducive to my being a good friend. Aristotle says that humans cannot stay long in a state of sadness. And since apathy makes us sad, we will either try to escape from what makes us sad or distract ourselves from thinking about it with something pleasant. These two responses are manifested by laziness, which is what we typically think of, and also busyness. We usually associate spiritual apathy with laziness, which with giving up in despair and doing nothing. The typical image of the slothful human being is the couch potato watching TV, eating chips. But we also can seek to escape the source of our sadness by distracting ourselves with many activities. We can rush about doing many things and feel some measure of satisfaction at our supposed productivity. But this only avoids the more important issue we should face and increases our apathy. Good friendships persist because the friends are willing to face the hard things friendship requires them to face. Our avoidance behaviors can make spiritual apathy a gateway vice to other vices like greed, gluttony, and lust. Why those vices? Because they each involve what we find very pleasant, money, food, and sex. And we seek pleasure to remedy sadness. If by my apathetic behavior I avoid spiritual goods, like my friendships with God and others, because they require that I make some sacrifice, and I instead seek pleasure to diminish my sadness, I'll find over time that even the pleasures I seek as an escape become diminished. This is because I'm using the pleasant thing to escape rather than wholeheartedly enjoying it. I want to make a qualification at this point. Sometimes there are actions that love requires that we don't have the energy or other resources needed to perform them well. Avoiding them temporarily is not apathy, but good sense. It's reasonable to wait for the right time to face difficult things, although we can be subject to self-deception here. In summary, spiritual apathy is damaging to friendships because by it I resist loving as friendship requires. I can become angry at those who call me to do good because that reminder renews my sadness. But by being a good friend and developing good friendships, by being a good friend and developing good friendships is crucial to happiness, and so we should work against spiritual apathy. How can we work against it specifically? First, we can recognize that friendships are crucial to happiness, that to be a good friend, one must sometimes sacrifice one's own comfort and pleasures for the good of the friend. Second, we should find ways to cultivate love for our friends when we see it lacking. For example, even if you're not feeling it, doing the loving thing over time will help. The 4th century monk Evagrius and the Benedictine monastic tradition recommends practicing stability of place, a third remedy. This means that I stay put. I don't try to escape. I face the issue that's causing my sadness and resolve it to the best of my ability. It's very easy to escape today. We have a highly mobile society and almost infinite number of amusements available literally at our fingertips. Sometimes it's reasonable to move on, but we should resist doing so when we're really running from what love is calling us to do. Fourth and finally, this requires perseverance, which is another remedy for apathy. Evagrius writes in his 8 Thoughts that, quote, "Perseverance is the cure for apathy, along with the execution of all tasks with great attention." It's not enough to stay put. A person must stay the course and resolutely attend to the task that will foster the love that's lacking. In these ways, we can grow to be more loving and better friends. Now, envy, the next vice that undermines human friendship, or undermines friendship, and it's also contrary to charity. So what is envy? Aquinas defines envy as sadness at another's good, insofar as the good of another is seen as an impediment to my own excellence. Sadness at another's good insofar as the good of another is seen as an impediment to my own excellence. So let's unpack this definition. Sadness here, like in spiritual apathy, can refer to 2 different things. On the one hand, it can refer to a free, deliberate withdrawing from the willing someone else's good. On the other, sadness can refer to emotional distress. How can we be sad over another's good? In the case of envy, we perceive the truly good thing that causes sadness to be something bad. We're distressed when we perceive that someone else is getting some good thing diminishes our own excellence. Because we treat the other's good as something that takes away our own good, we treat what is good for them as bad for us. Hence, in envy, the other's good makes me sad. Consider an example. Suppose my friend gets a better grade than me on a test, and I feel sad at her having gotten that grade. I'm saddened by it. I begin to wish she hadn't got that grade, but instead that she had gotten a lower grade than me. That's envy. What's going on? I'm upset because she got a higher grade than me, and perhaps her getting the grade makes me feel inferior to her. Perhaps I just really wanted to be the top of the class, and she beat me to it. Either way, her higher score is the source of my distress, and so I begin to wish she had never got that grade, even though it was good for her to do so. I may even begin to make excuses for why I didn't score higher, or attribute her good grade to luck when it was really a result of her hard work. The genuine good of another, her growth, accomplishments, etc., contributes to her flourishing, and if I love her, or at least have a basic goodwill towards her, I should rejoice in her good, or at least not be pained by it, and wish she didn't have it. But envy is contrary to this goodwill. When I envy another person, I withdraw from her good rather than willing it. I'm pained and distressed by her having the good and wish she didn't. Before unpacking the negative effects of this distress, it's worth distinguishing envy from something that is good but that seems like envy. Suppose a friend works hard over the summer and saves up enough money to go on a trip. And he posts his adventures on social media. And when I see them, I have a mixed reaction. On the one hand, I'm glad for him to have had this trip. But on the other hand, I also feel sad that I haven't been on such a great trip. Is that envy? No. Aquinas' following Aristotle distinguishes envy from something that looks like it, called zeal. Aquinas writes that zeal is, quote, when persons are saddened at the fact that they themselves do not have good things that their neighbors do, that their neighbor does. The zealous person then seeks to imitate the other so that he too can attain the good. So I may work hard to save up so that I can go on a trip like my friend. Zeal is different from envy, for the envious person is saddened at the fact that their neighbor has good things that they themselves do not have. The difference is subtle. Zeal is sadness that I lack a good that another has without being sad that they have it. In contrast, the envious is saddened that the other has it. And they're glad if the other loses it. Zeal is consistent with loving the other and willing them to have the good. But envy is inconsistent with loving the other, for the envious wishes the other didn't have the good thing. So, what are some of the bad effects of envy? The first is that it undermines charity. Charity towards others requires that we will their good. It's a failure of goodwill to respond negatively to the real good of another, but that's exactly what happens in envy. For those who've played sports, think of when you were young and you were taught good sportsmanship. At the end of the game, you went out to shake hands with the opposing team and tell them good game. The poor sport was the one who sulked and fumed over a loss and wouldn't shake the hands of the other team. The poor sport refused to will the good of the other. The poor sport was in the grip of envy. Envy makes it much harder for us to love our friends, and harder to be a good friend. It's really difficult to be around people who are the source of sadness to us, and it's difficult to have a friendship that's marked by a need to be superior to your friend. Envy also begets offspring, such as gossip and distraction. The envious may attempt to tear down the person envied and show she is not as good as others think. The envious gossips when he disparages the one he envies in secret or a disguised way. He tears them down openly by distraction. The envious does this because he thinks tearing down the other will remedy his sadness. Unfortunately, envy doesn't stop there. It can degenerate into hatred for the other person. In this context, to hate the other is to wish for the other's misfortune absolutely. For example, envy may start in an athlete because someone else fairly beats him for a starting spot on the team. Hate results when he not only wishes that the other wouldn't have that spot, but when he wishes that bad things would happen to the other person altogether. This leads the envier to exult or rejoice at the other's adversity, say if the other seems to get a serious injury or something really bad happens to him, or to distress if the envied prospers, Say a further examination by the doctor reveals the injury isn't serious, or if something really good happens to him. The hateful person is worse than the envious because they are totally set against the good, the other's good, rather than just one way. How can we avoid envy or work against it? Envy stems from a comparative sense of self-value, to use De Young's phrase, or an excessive desire to be the best, or both. To combat envy, we have to disconnect self-value from a winning comparison with others. A comparative sense of self-value is easy to come by in our culture. We see that material rewards often go to the winners. And if we don't have a clear sense for what gives us value, we can take false consolation in the thought that at least we're better than the next guy. A more robust sense of self-value will be rooted in one's own intrinsic value, stemming from one's nature, unique traits, and gifts one's received, and from being loved by God. These sources of value don't depend on winning comparisons with others. A second remedy is to pay attention to and cultivate concern for the goods we share with others rather than competitive goods. For example, when I share knowledge or an experience of beauty with someone, I don't lose any of that knowledge or experience. I can't envy a person if her having a good doesn't diminish my having it too. A third and final remedy is to practice good zeal. Focus on what you can do to become better and try to love the one you're tempted to envy and imitate him so that you can be worthy of the good that he has. I'll conclude this talk with a discussion of another virtue, an application of the virtue of prudence to friendships. Prudence is wisdom about what's to be done. In particular, I want to focus on how a friend is both loving and wise in helping her friend to know himself and to avoid mistakes by correcting him. Correcting our friends poorly can result in losing them, so we want to be wise when doing so. So let's learn from Aquinas' wise advice in this matter from his Summa Theologiae. Aquinas discusses fraternal correction or friendly reproof, in which we confront our friends about something that they've already done or something they are planning to do that is wrong. A true friend loves us for our own sake and wants us to flourish. But wrong actions always wound us and detract from our flourishing. So a good friend will help us in this way at times. He or she will not always be on the lookout for sin and pry into others' lives, but he or she will at the proper time correct the friend, for love demands that we help our friends to flourish. But how do you do this well, without being obnoxious or unsuccessful or lose your friend? Fraternal correction is to correct a person's fault out of charity, love for the other person and for that person's own good. And to do so properly, we have to meet five conditions. First, we must have good judgment about the fault. Do I see clearly? I should not seek to correct a friend on the basis of suspicion, but must clearly understand the issue at hand. Sometimes we have to remove a log from our own eye before we can see the speck on our friend's. Second, we must be motivated by love for the friend and his flourishing. Am I really doing this out of love, or am I doing it from pride, or from some ulterior motive? Third, we should reasonably believe that the friend trusts us. In other words, that the friend believes that I have good judgment and that I'm motivated by love for him or her. Sometimes our friends trust us in some areas of life, but not in others. Is this one in which my friend trusts me? Why does this matter? If my friend does not trust me, I will not likely succeed in correcting my friend and may make my friend worse and harm the friendship. Similarly, if I've corrected them too frequently already, the friend may be unwilling to listen again. Such failures conflict with the loving motivation that impels the correction in the first place. I want him to improve, not get worse. Fourth, we must correct when our friend is in a place to receive it. Usually, we should not try to correct a friend when they're exhausted, depressed, angry, or in a mood that makes them unlikely to receive it. Furthermore, we should generally avoid correcting in public or in front of others. The virtues of justice and love require us to be sensitive about the reputation of others and to protect that important good out of love for them. That does not mean that there are not cases where public correction might be necessary because of the urgency of the situation, but they're not typical. In summary, we must ask, are these the right circumstances for this correction? Fifth and finally, in light of these considerations, we must determine whether we have reasonable hope that our friend will receive the correction in these circumstances rather than reject it, injure our friendship, or become worse. If I think it will likely make them worse, then love bids me to refrain and not correct them. That's why prudence is needed, wisdom is needed, and love is absolutely essential for correcting a friend. I should be clear, good friends help the friend to know himself, including his faults, but this is not motivated by judgmentalism, but by love for the friend. Such friends together will flourish because they will charitably help each other to pursue a more fulfilling life and become partners in a pursuit of happiness that benefits them both. In summary and conclusion of the whole, we should all seek to avoid spiritual apathy and envy and grow in charity and practical wisdom, especially with respect to fraternal correction. To do so and to be a good friend, here are the top 10 tips. Number 1, pursue an adequate vision of human flourishing. Number 2, remember what makes a good friend. Number 3, recognize the true value of good friendship. Number 4, love your friend primarily for his or her own sake and not because they are pleasant or useful. Number 5, practice stability of place. Don't run away. Number 6, persevere in doing what love demands when you don't feel like it. Number 7, don't seek self-value from a winning comparison with others. Number 8, pursue shared goods. Number 9, practice zeal. And number 10, wisely correct your friend from love with good judgment in the right circumstances. Doing so will help you be a good friend and build the kind of friendships that enable you to flourish together. Thank you very much, and I look forward to your questions.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.